Hey, a quick heads up. This episode has some cursing and it's about drug use. So be careful if you're listening around kids. And I want to start on a walk. It's a cold day in November and I just met up with Anne and Daryl. They're this couple in their 30s and they live in a small town called Austin, Indiana.
Where are we headed?
I'll need to tell these buildings. If that's okay.
It's okay by me.
We started a needle exchange where people get syringes and other supplies to inject drugs, and we crossed the street towards the back of a cannery in town, in plain view of a police station. Anyone watching us would think to themselves, those guys are going to shoot up, and they'd be right. What Anne and Daryl are about to do is illegal, which is why we're protecting their identities by using their middle names. And it's also why I'm nervous.
Where are we walking again?
Just to the train. In between these buildings and sneaking in between.
I keep asking that because I want to get out of sight. Anne and Daryl, though, they're in a hurry, but relaxed. They have a lot more experience with this stuff than I do.
When we first met, we actually shot alcohol. Shot vodka, didn't we? Like, where my sister's old house.
He shot pine salt, we've shot Kool-Aid, we've shot dirty mud puddle water, anything.
Eventually, we make it back behind this warehouse by some train tracks.
We're just going right here.
We're out of sight, and I can see that this is a popular spot. Used syringes are everywhere.
No, oh, yeah, there's a syringe right by your head, too.
It was stuck right in the wall where we settle in. Daryl hasn't used in a while, and he's sick from withdrawals. He feels nauseous and achy and has hot and cold flashes, so he gets to work. He loads up a couple syringes, and he takes one of them, sticks the needle in a vein in his arm, and pushes down the plunger.
So, like, what does it feel like?
It makes you feel what? You feel 100% better as soon as you do it. Like, I was definitely sick before I did that.
But if you watch Daryl closely, he doesn't put heroin in the syringes. Daryl and Anne inject a drug meant to help treat opioid addiction, a medication called buprenorphine. From the Public Radio Reporting Collaborative, Side Effects Public Media, this is The Workaround.
Stories of the difficult and sometimes shocking things people do to get around America's healthcare system and get the help they need.
I'm Jake Harper.
And I'm Emily Foreman. So, Jake, what healthcare workaround did you find?
Well, people are illegally buying a prescription medication on the street so they can stay away from illegal drugs. Anne and Daryl use something called buprenorphine. It's this opioid that's long-acting, and for people who use heroin or other opioids, buprenorphine prevents withdrawals and reduces cravings. It works kind of how a nicotine patch works for smokers. A lot of people know buprenorphine under the brand name Suboxone, which looks almost like a little Listerine breath strip. This is the version that Anne and Daryl inject, which, by the way, is not how you're supposed to use it. But they don't have a real prescription, and so they tend to use smaller amounts, like a sixth or eighth of a strip, and injecting it allows them to feel it.
Why don't they have a real prescription?
Well, a buprenorphine prescription can be hard to get, so there's no shortage of people who might need a medication like this.
So we're in this really intense opioid crisis. Millions of people are addicted to opioids across the United States. And there's a drug that helps people manage their addiction. But they're forced to buy it illegally because they don't have access?
Yeah, so there's a huge demand. And there just aren't many doctors or nurses that prescribe this drug, especially in rural areas like Austin. You have to get a special waiver to prescribe buprenorphine. And once you do, there are limits to how many patients you can treat. And this limit is unique to buprenorphine. Like, a doctor can write as many prescriptions as they want for painkillers or antibiotics, but they can't do that for buprenorphine. So it's basically a supply and demand problem. There's a limited number of buprenorphine treatment slots. And for people like Anne and Daryl, getting one of those slots can be really hard. There's all sorts of barriers that can interfere. So instead, they work around the healthcare system, and they buy buprenorphine on the street in a sort of black market.
How did you find them?
Well, I've reported a lot in this small town called Austin, Indiana. If Austin, Indiana sounds familiar, it's because 3 years ago, Austin made international news.
Well, an outbreak of the HIV virus in Indiana is spreading so fast, a team from the CDC is now involved, and the state's governor was forced to extend a health emergency declared last month.
It was the worst outbreak in a rural community in U.S. history. There's only a few thousand people who live there, but more than 200 people were infected. And that's mostly blamed on people sharing needles when they injected a prescription painkiller called Opana. And I think that's when the state of Indiana started to wake up to the opioid epidemic.
A prescription painkiller called Opana had been reformulated, and addicts found they now needed to inject it to reach a euphoric high.
Actually, that needle exchange we started our walk at didn't exist back then. Needle exchanges were illegal, and the state actually legalized them after the outbreak. So that's actually where I met Daryl and Ann, and it turns out they're at the center of this whole Austin story. Daryl grew up in Austin, and he does odd jobs around town like yard work or construction.
I enjoy building things, you know. After things are done, I just stand back and look at it like I did that.
And he said he fell into drug use as a teenager. He smoked weed with his uncle and eventually tried meth.
I've been doing meth since I've been about 15, so.
Like, when did you try opiates?
Opiates, I was about 18 or 19.
Okay, and was it pills?
Yeah, I started off with Oxycontins.
Ann grew up in a bigger town a few miles away and told me she dabbled with marijuana and Robitussin when she was younger, but she didn't get into opioids until later. You know, she went to college and actually still dreams about going back to school and getting her PhD.
How did Ann end up on opioids?
So Ann worked as a domestic violence advocate, and she actually had to quit her job because her own husband was abusive.
I couldn't see clients and stuff because I was black and blue, and they wanted me to take some time off and heal from it, and then I was kind of stuck at home, and all of a sudden I wasn't used to being there all the time with my kiddo and not really having anything productive to do.
Eventually she and her husband got divorced, and she got together with an old boyfriend, and that guy used Opana. And she said between the trauma she had been through with her husband and not having a job to go to every day, Opana was really appealing.
I was just having a hard time with it, and he snuck down to my basement, and I was, what are you doing? And I walked downstairs, and there was brown liquid in a spoon, and I met Opanas. And just kind of being around it and just watching everybody, I was like, well, I want to nod out. I want to go into that happy little place. And it was probably another 3 or 4 months, and then I finally did it.
How did Ann and Daryl meet?
Well, it's sort of a strange love story. They committed a crime together. They preferred not to say what it was, but about 6 years ago, Ann was dating a guy, Daryl's cousin. They needed money and knew how to get it. But late at night, before they could go and do whatever it was, their third person canceled.
And we were like, oh shit, we gotta get somebody else. We need another body. And yeah, the dipshit happened to be walking up the road at 2 a.m.
Is she talking about Daryl?
Yeah, so Daryl got in the truck, and they went and did whatever it was.
Yeah, we ended up going to, like, McDonald's afterwards, bought something to eat, and offered to buy her a drink because he was being a dick and wouldn't buy her one, so.
Daryl bought Ann a drink, flirted with her a little, and the next day she was walking around town, needed help finding a vein, and she ran into Daryl again.
Oh, well, hey, dude. I'm like, can you hit me? He started laughing hilariously. He's like, well, yeah, I can. And I'm like, I have a bunch of heroin if you can hit me.
So drugs brought them together?
Yeah, and drugs are still a big part of the relationship. But Ann's boyfriend at the time wasn't real happy that they hung out without him and got upset. Ann said he went around town, fired a couple gunshots into an apartment floor. So he got arrested and went to jail, and Daryl was kind of like, great.
Oh, well, you might as well be with me now. And like 2 months later, I was pregnant with our daughter.
Their daughter was born, and Daryl and Ann kept using drugs. Then in late 2014, they both got some news. Ann was actually in rehab, and they tested everyone for STDs.
And I already knew that I had Hep C.
But she wasn't ready for the other result.
And she comes back in, and I'm like, it's okay, I already know I've got it. And she's like, well, you're handling this really well. I'm thinking she's talking about Hep C. So, no.
Ann tested positive for HIV. She left rehab, told Daryl to come meet her. And Daryl said that right when she called, he and some friends had just finished using a pill, and they shared a needle.
I shot first. My buddy shot second, his buddy shot second, and his old lady shot last.
So Daryl and his friends drive to where Ann is, and she tells him she has HIV and that he probably has it too.
I have to go back out to the car where them four dudes is and tell them that I'm, you know, that's the hardest thing I ever done was look at my best friend in the face after we just did a pill, and I tell him I had HIV. My whole world stopped.
Ann and Daryl were two of the first people to be diagnosed in the Austin HIV outbreak. When investigators started looking into it, they wanted to know who Ann and Daryl's sex partners were and who they had shared needles with.
I don't have a bunch of sexual partners. It's just been my baby dad. But if you want needle-sharing partners, then you're going to need a bigger piece of paper. And we ended up giving them about 80 names, I think. And then we had an epidemic.
Some people in Austin say the epidemic was a wake-up call for them. They got help with their addiction. But even though Ann and Daryl were some of the first people to be diagnosed with HIV, they didn't get help with their addiction. They kept using, and they were in and out of the correction system. Daryl said he saw HIV as a sort of death sentence, and he went on a bender.
I definitely did. I ain't give a crap about nothing, nobody. I don't give a fuck about nothing, because my life was over with. I was dying. I got fucking HIV. Fuck them all. I'm going to do what, you know what I'm saying? That's the way I felt.
Daryl ended up going to prison, and when he got out last year, he said he was right back at it.
Before I left the parking lot of the prison, I was shooting up getting high.
Wow. Ann says she doesn't use as much without Daryl around because she doesn't live in Austin. She's a few miles away. But when Daryl got out of prison and started using drugs again, she went with him.
We started to go down that road, and I was like, we're never going to see our kid grow up.
And around the time she had that realization, a few things happened. One was that Ann survived an overdose. She was lucky. And then heroin and pills became hard to find in Austin. Daryl and Ann were sick from withdrawals and just tired of the grind of having to find and pay for drugs every day.
And then we sat sick for about 3 days, and he woke up and he's like, we're both going to get out of Suboxone. So I've just kind of been doing that ever since.
So Ann and Daryl have this moment where they're like, it's time to stop, time to get our life on track and be there for our kid. And they turn to Suboxone to help them do this. But don't they have to have a prescription? So how do they get it?
Right. So in Austin, it's really common to use illicit buprenorphine. Daryl told me the Opanas are almost gone. And people told me the heroin in town sometimes just isn't that good if you can even find it. So that leaves buprenorphine. And when I went to Austin, I would see people walking around town looking for someone with buprenorphine to sell. And I actually saw drug deals go down. And the reason this illegal market exists for buprenorphine is due to something called diversion. So diversion is what happens anytime someone gives their prescription drug to someone else. And when it comes to buprenorphine, a lot of people see diversion as a big problem.
Because it's illegal?
Yeah, and because of the history of the opioid epidemic. For a long time, opioid painkillers were really easy to get, especially at these standalone pain clinics.
Meaning pill mills?
Yeah, exactly. Those pill mills are seen as a huge contributor to the opioid epidemic. People would sell or share their prescriptions. And a lot of people I've talked to and read about see buprenorphine diversion the same way.
This is a drug that, if used in the right way, can be a positive.
This is Kentucky's Attorney General Andy Beshear talking to NPR last year.
But allowing this drug to be abused, and abused in a way that is so similar, if not identical, to our pill mill issue that we worked so hard to resolve. We worked so hard to shut them down. If we can't learn from our past and make sure we don't repeat those mistakes, then shame on us.
So he's on this national stage saying buprenorphine clinics are contributing to the opioid crisis, just like the pill mills did. And I've heard judges and attorneys and a lot of other people make the same basic argument. Buprenorphine is an opioid that can get you high, and diverting it is illegal. And it's understandable why they would feel that way. Both of those things are technically true. And for someone like Beshear, his job is to enforce the law. But
what?
After looking into it, I think there's an argument to be made here that, unlike other prescription opioids, diversion of buprenorphine could actually be a force for good. So as I was getting into this, I talked to Michelle Lofwall. She's an addiction specialist in Kentucky, and she deals a lot with diversion.
I've spent a lot of time thinking about the topic, and I write about it.
Lofwall and other experts made me think about this diversion issue a bit differently. Because first off, diversion happens all the time with all sorts of drugs. Take sleeping pills. People share their sleeping pills all the time.
You know, that's a controlled substance. That's diversion.
Yeah, I mean, one time I took some of my friend's Adderall.
Yeah, and I've taken someone's Xanax. Like, I knew what I needed. I didn't want to go to a doctor, pay them, pay for the prescription. And these are the same kinds of reasons buprenorphine diversion happens. Our healthcare system is complicated and expensive.
If you acknowledge that and you get some basic education that you know that there is a medication that is available to you, but you don't have the money to pay the doctor for it, there will be a black market for it.
And the black market could be a lifesaver. Like, say you're diabetic and you don't get your insulin, you could die. The same thing is true of buprenorphine.
But how is using buprenorphine on the street different from heroin or pill addiction? Like, it's still an opioid, right?
So I'd say it's different for two main reasons. One is that buprenorphine is just different from other opioids. So first of all, buprenorphine has a really strong attraction to the opioid receptors in your brain. It's kind of a bully. It will actually block other opioids from getting to the receptors, and it makes them less effective or can even block them completely. And buprenorphine's effects on the opioid receptors are weaker than heroin or fentanyl. So if you take buprenorphine while you have other opioids in your system, buprenorphine will come in and replace those opioids. And since it has a weaker effect, it can take your high away or even put you in withdrawals.
So can you actually get high on buprenorphine?
Yeah, it's possible to get high from buprenorphine for people who don't have a high tolerance for opioids, like people who aren't addicted. But if you want to get high, like that's what you're looking to do, there are just better drugs for that. Buprenorphine has something called a ceiling effect. After you take a certain amount, you won't be able to get any higher if you take more. It also means that it's hard to overdose on buprenorphine. I want to be clear here because it is possible to overdose, especially if you mix it with other drugs like benzodiazepines, so that's Xanax, but it's uncommon. I looked up stats for Marion County, where Indianapolis is, and out of more than 1,500 opioid-related overdoses that happened from 2010 to 2017, only 12 people had buprenorphine in their system. And only one person died from buprenorphine by itself. And the other thing I think is so important in all this is that diversion, this black market, whatever you want to call it, it's how so many people try this medication for the first time.
So getting back to Ann and Daryl, that's how they used it for the first time, right? What was their experience like?
So a lot of people first try illicit buprenorphine when they're in withdrawals. Like their dealer might not have any heroin or pills, or their friends run out. Daryl tried it the same way. Like he was in withdrawals. He used a little bit of Suboxone. And that's when he realized how different buprenorphine is.
Because withdrawing heroin is bad, but it hurts all over. You hurt all over. You're sick. You puke. You got the diarrhea. As soon as I done a Suboxone, all that quit. All that went away.
Did you feel high or did you feel normal?
I felt, at first, I felt like I was high. But I think it's where I've not felt normal in so long. I think that's what normal feels like now. You know what I'm saying? It's just, I've not been normal in a long time, so.
So that was their first taste of buprenorphine. Did that make them want to continue using it and stop using drugs?
Yeah, exactly. And what came next is maybe the most magical part of all of this. People are out there and they get this medication illegally. They use it incorrectly. Like, it's probably not the right dose. And in a lot of cases, people inject or snort it, which is definitely not how you're supposed to use it. But even though it isn't used correctly, it keeps people out of harm's way and it can help lead people to real treatment. Ann and Daryl fell into a routine with buprenorphine. And when I met them, they had used it almost exclusively for a month and a half. They self-treated with buprenorphine for that time period. And they said that doing that allowed them to sort of take a step back and really examine the downsides to using other opioids.
Because you lose the urge and the seeking it out and the whole process and the, like, wanting all the stuff around you and wanting the supplies and just the lifestyle and getting out there and just the routine of it all. And we'll sit around and Kobe like, man, wouldn't it be nice to have a pill? I'm like, no, screw a pill. I want a bunch of heroin. And then we'll sit and tell some war story about some. And then we'll, more we talk, about 10 minutes later, he'll be like, all right, so we're going to go to part of strip. I'm like, I guess so.
And this kind of experience with buprenorphine can make people realize, hey, I want to do this treatment thing for real. And that's what happened with Daryl. The day I met him, he came into the clinic there in Austin to try to sign up for insurance because he wanted to get real treatment.
But I'm at the point in my life now to where I know that I've got to change something or I'm going to go back to prison. I'm going to end up dying of fucking HIV. No, it's going to turn into AIDS and I'm going to die of AIDS or something because of that. Because when I'm getting high on heroin or Opana, I don't care about nothing. I ain't worried about taking on medications. I ain't none of that. I was fuck it all.
Like, do you think trying it on the street the way that you have has led you to this?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think where if I hadn't ever started them on the street, I wouldn't be sitting here right now talking to you. You know, because I wouldn't have no interest in doing nothing but fucking getting high.
Is this common, people trying it first on the street and then seeking real treatment?
Yeah, it is. Michelle Offwall, the addiction specialist in Kentucky, told me she's seen people come into her office specifically because they tried it on the street first.
We see that. I've seen that happen with people coming in wanting treatment specifically because they've had it and they know it works for them and they want to get it legally and they don't want to, you know, get a felony on their record for using it, and they want to get their life back. And so that, I think, is the huge thing.
And that's not just her experience. The research she and others have done backs this up. People don't often use buprenorphine to get high. They use it to avoid withdrawals, and in some cases, to stay away from other opioids entirely, like Ann and Daryl. Basically, they try to treat themselves, and they do that because they can't get into regular treatment.
Look, you know, these people want help, and they tried, and they didn't succeed, and so now they're going to go get it when it's available. And that kind of just made sense to me. Like, I could imagine myself doing a similar thing.
But is self-treatment really a replacement for real treatment?
So, no. Loffwahl says this workaround isn't a good replacement for real addiction treatment. Like, it's not going to fix the opioid epidemic.
Like, I don't buy this that, you know, we just need to give everyone buprenorphine and make it available on the street, and that's going to be the answer. I don't see that.
For one thing, a lot of people who struggle with addiction have other mental health problems that a psychiatrist could help them address. Both Ann and Daryl told me this was the case for them.
I hear voices. I hear screaming. Like, different things trigger. It makes it sound like there's a female out here in the parking lot being beaten, raped, and killed. Like, every night I hear it every night. It's in my head. I got to have some kind of psychiatric help with it.
But even if you're just talking about buprenorphine, people need a doctor or nurse to help them figure out the right dose and to write them a prescription so they can take it every day at the right time. And if you don't have that regular dose, like you can't find a provider or you don't have insurance or another way to pay for that, the consequences can be severe. Yeah. I went down to Austin again in January, so it was a few months after I had met Ann and Daryl, and I met them up by that needle exchange again.
Well, my hope is to not keep you guys very long, but I just want to, like, get an update on things and,
We've both OD'd on heroin. Like, really? I did OD two times on Christmas Eve and once on Christmas morning.
OD on Christmas?
Yeah, once on Christmas morning and Christmas Day.
No, what was after that? I think it was New Year's Day.
Might have been, but yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was New Year's.
Three times in a row. So I'm doing good.
And he said Ann overdosed too, and he brought her back with Narcan, which reverses opioid overdoses.
I breathe for over 7 minutes. I gave her Narcan shots, and I brought her out of it, but she's still good.
What happened to using buprenorphine?
Well, Daryl wanted to go to the doctor for a prescription, but he never managed to get insurance. Then the person he and Ann bought from lost their prescription.
I guess I don't quite understand why buprenorphine treatment is so hard to get. How is it different from other types of drugs? Like, why is buprenorphine treated so differently?
So I talked with Basha Ndraka-Christou. She's a researcher at University of Central Florida, and she's writing a book about the barriers to addiction treatment. And she says getting addiction treatment is really complex. It's like everything else in healthcare, but worse.
It is so many barriers. I have yet to identify another area of medicine with so many barriers. It's from every angle. It's from the lack of providers, from, you know, being in a population that's already statistically less likely to have good quality insurance and less money, from, you know, not having transportation to get there, to not having, you know, oftentimes a good support system.
So that's from the patient side. And then again, for doctors and nurses and PAs, there's that patient limit, which actually has gotten better in the last couple of years. But there's still a limit, which, again, is unusual. And then there are a bunch of other processes that get in the way, too. Like, insurance can make prescribers jump through a bunch of hoops. It's common for insurance to require that patients get counseling to get buprenorphine.
I mean, we never do the opposite. We never say, you know, you're not going to get your counseling unless you take medication. That's just a very non-person-centered, antiquated way of doing things.
And if you're a doctor, all of these things are extra work. It's way easier to just say, no, I'm not going to do that. And then Ndraka-Christou said there's a major issue that just affects the whole addiction treatment system in the United States.
There are just layers upon layers of stigma.
What did you learn about stigma in your reporting, and how does that play out in Austin?
Some people I talked to in Austin seem to equate buprenorphine with just another addiction. And some of that I think is because they know people in Austin are injecting it. And that's maybe more common there than other places. People I talked to in Indianapolis who had used Suboxone said they snorted it. But either way, I think people see this drug being used like that and they think this is the same thing as heroin. But if you zoom out and look across the country, this attitude toward buprenorphine is really common. A lot of 12-step groups are hostile toward medications like buprenorphine, and even a lot of addiction counselors are against them. It's just hard to grasp this idea of using an opioid to treat opioid addiction, especially when you see that it's being used incorrectly on the street. It's being diverted. And from what I've seen, the instinct for people who view it that way is to limit the supply. I mean, to be clear, there are doctors out there that are probably prescribing too much and taking only cash, which kind of pushes people to sell it since it's hard to pay out of pocket. So the instinct is to crack down on doctors who might be overprescribing and add a bunch of regulations that may make it even less attractive for doctors to start prescribing it. There was even a law proposed in Indiana this year that would have done that.
But if you limit the supply like that, won't it be even harder for people to access the treatment they need?
Yeah, and if you talk to addiction experts like Andraka Christou, they say even though some of these prescribers out there might not be the best people to get addiction treatment from, cracking down on the supply just leaves people suffering from addiction with a choice. It's not a choice about whether you're going to use or not, because the disease of addiction doesn't let you choose that.
They're either going to go and buy heroin and get high, okay, which surely is not a great policy solution here, or they're going to go buy the Suboxone on the street. I mean, that's really, you're going to be causing one of the two options. There's no such thing as a patient who's going to say, oh, there's this doctor is not available that I want, therefore I'm just going to quit using drugs altogether and life will be rosy.
You know, this is a life-saving drug for people with opioid addiction. So the solution, according to addiction experts, is to open up the supply, make it easier to get. It might increase diversion in the short term, but maybe that's not the worst thing in the world. And as I've been looking into this issue, for the first time, I've started to see that some policymakers at the national level are starting to make the same arguments.
To those who would say we need more data or we need to be cautious about expanding access to treatment, I would respond that more and more people are dying in the street every day. We don't have time to drag our feet any longer.
This is Democratic Congressman Paul Tonko of New York, and he's addressing the House Energy and Commerce Committee back in May.
They aren't dying because there is too much buprenorphine out there. People aren't dying in the streets from buprenorphine overdoses. They are dying because there isn't enough access to treatment. It's that simple.
And they're debating this exact issue, whether or not people like Ann and Daryl buying it on the street is really as harmful as people make it out to be. So Tonko wrote a bill that would let more nurses prescribe buprenorphine to expand access to it. His solution is to make it easier to get so people don't have to get it illegally.
Who's against the bill?
Well, there were a few organizations that apparently expressed concerns.
The American Psychiatric Association, Opioid Treatment Program Consortium.
That's the chair of the committee, Congressman Greg Walden, a Republican from Oregon. And he read from a letter that he got from the Drug Enforcement Administration.
Buprenorphine is widely diverted. And it cannot be assumed that simply giving out more buprenorphine will help and not harm.
So on the majority side, you've got Republicans who are making these arguments about diversion to not expand treatment. And that day, they voted to table Tonko's proposal. Like, it looked like it wasn't going to move forward. And Democrats, the supporters of Tonko's proposal, were upset.
We know that bup saves lives.
This is Democrat Frank Pallone of New Jersey.
DEA is saying that it may be diverted. To what? The street? And so people would get bup and they would use it to save their lives. And that's a bad thing. I mean, look, I'm not saying that I want stuff to be available on the street rather than through qualified providers. But there's this whole idea of diversion of bup is not something that I quite understand why that's necessarily even a bad thing.
This whole thing went on for a while, but before the meeting ended, Tonko chimed in again.
This has worked, but it hasn't reached the people we need to. And so every day, every week, every month, every year that passes that we don't allow this service delivery, we have to understand that someone is going to lose a loved one. They're going to lose a sibling, a parent, a child, a neighbor, a friend, because we're not acting on service delivery. Let's quit the dynamics that are fake. And let's go forward with a program that has worked.
General Lee's time's
expired.
That will
keep people from using buprenorphine on the street because they can't get treatment.
So that's it then? The proposal's just dead?
Well, it looked like it was dead. But then in June, it got added back into a big House opioid package. I'm not sure what kind of backroom dealings happened, but it seems like, you know, how upset people were over this resulted in the proposal getting placed back on the docket. And it passed the House.
So what happens now?
Well, it still has to clear the Senate, and they're not expected to take it up until later this year. So basically nothing's going to happen quickly. But there is change happening sort of at a lower level. Like, more and more doctors and nurses are signing up to prescribe buprenorphine. because they realize how important it is for the people that they treat and, you know, in general, how important it is for the country to have prescribers out there that can get this drug to people in a legal, safe way so that they don't have to divert it. But for the time being, it's just still really hard for people to get.
So where does that leave Ann and Daryl?
Well, their story doesn't really have a happy ending, at least not yet. Ann and Daryl, they've each had their own struggles with insurance coverage and getting a provider. And I think when they lost their supply of illicit buprenorphine, they kind of lost their drive to clear those hurdles again. Addiction is just hard. Like, relapse is always a possibility, and it can take years for people to conquer addiction. But still, this experiment that they did, those few months that they were on buprenorphine, this could end up being a part of that journey because it allowed them to look forward to a time that they're not addicted anymore. You know, Daryl wants to find regular work, and Anne says she wants to get her master's or PhD and continue doing social work. She even takes these free courses online.
Everybody makes fun of me and calls me a dork. I'm like, I'm going back to grad school, you guys. And they all just laugh at me, and they're like, oh, hey, we're going to get high and odd. I'm like, okay, well, I'll get high and odd, too. And then I wake up and do my homework. So get 100% of my quizzes. But, yeah. Yeah, I'm a nerd.
So you're hoping to continue to be a nerd into the future?
Oh, that's not going to ever stop. Yeah, I'm going to be a nerd for the rest of my life.
What about you? Like, what do you think you'd want to be doing?
I would probably go to some kind of vocational school or something and get get a welder's degree and try to do weld underwater. I mean, I definitely had a way different mindset than what I do now.
Yeah.
I got a lot more interest to do stuff than what I did have. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I got a lot more goals set than what I did have. Besides waking up in the morning, figuring out how I can make fucking $60 to get high with. I don't got that goal no more. My goal is to, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Try to get a job, try to do everything, try to do like normal people. I want to be normal again. I want to work, I want to build something.
Addiction just keeps setting them back. Ann and Daryl can see a way out, but they're not quite ready to take it. Thanks for listening to The Workaround.
If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, give us a rating, and tell a friend.
Thanks to Emily Foreman for being my co-host, and make sure to listen to her episode of this podcast as well.
And thanks to Jake for bringing us a story on this episode.
The show is edited by Sadie Babbitts and produced by Matt Hodapp.
Thanks to Starly Kind for her early thinking on this project.
The Workaround is brought to you by Side Effects Public Media.
We're a regional health reporting group based at NPR member station WFYI in Indianapolis.
KBIA in Columbia, Missouri, St. Louis Public Radio, WILL in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, WNIN in Evansville, Indiana, and WOSU in Columbus, Ohio all contribute to Side Effects. And finally, a special thanks to Carmel Roth. She's the former editor and founder of Side Effects Public Media, who created the idea of The Workaround. I'm Jake Harper.
And I'm Emily Foreman. Thanks for listening.